I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, what's going on in Colombia? Over 700 hostages are being held. One may soon be released with the 3-year-old son fathered by her captor. But first, there are claims today that at least 4 top White House lawyers, including then-White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez and Harriet Myers, took part in discussions about those CIA videotapes showing the harsh interrogations of terrorism suspects. Today's New York Times calls that involvement more extensive than White House officials have acknowledged, and the Times claimed there was, quote, vigorous sentiment among at least some White House officials to destroy the tapes. The White House is calling the story pernicious and troubling and is asking for a formal correction, and the whole issue is the subject of a hearing in federal court tomorrow. For starters, we called Mark Mazzetti, the New York Times reporter who co-authored today's story, and asked him if he stands by his report.
Absolutely. If you read the White House statement, at no point in the statement are they challenging any of the facts of the story. And they've asked for a correction on the subheadline, which is underneath the main headline of the story. They're saying that was misleading.
The subheadline is White House role was wider than it said. And that's what they're asking you to correct?
Yes. And they're challenging on a technical point that the White House hasn't said anything publicly about this, or any officials have not made public comment besides President Bush's denial that he knew anything about it. I believe that we're actually will be running a correction about the headline saying that conceding that point that they've not said anything publicly about it.
And yet, had they said things on background to indicate that Harriet Myers, for instance,
there have been, I mean, as we say in the story, there were Bush administration officials who were discussing this matter. But on the issue of the substance of the story and everything that we reported, we certainly will stand by it 100% because we believe it's accurate and it was not challenged today.
That's New York Times correspondent Mark Mazzetti. He co-reported today's story of alleged White House involvement in discussions about the destruction of CIA interrogation videotapes. Well, we now turn to Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He joins us from his cell phone. And Richard, what do you make of these new developments in the story?
Well, it's remarkable that the White House is even commenting on it at all, because this is such a heavily lawyered story now, given that there's legal proceedings and there are lawyers all over it, that until this story, they've basically stonewalled. Now, as this story has developed since it first broke a couple of weeks ago, we've seen lots of reports about pretty extensive involvement across the administration. And Newsweek reported just this week about the then Director of National Intelligence being involved, John Negroponte at the time, now Deputy Secretary of State. So it's clear that lots of people were involved, but of course, you've got conflicting accounts. And again, while it's in the hands of the lawyers, it's not clear when we're going to get a true and full picture.
If it's murky as to whether or not anyone at the White House said destroy the tapes, on the other hand, is it pretty clear that no one at the White House gave an order to preserve the tapes?
Right, exactly. No one gave an order either way, but maybe they did it verbally, and maybe there were rival bases of power inside the administration arguing different things. How you reconstitute that debate, given that executive privilege will be invoked, there may have been more of a verbal discussion than a written discussion, that's going to be very hard to unpick.
Well, the White House says it's going to continue to decline to comment on this issue. How long can it continue to do that?
All the way until the courts have resolved it. I mean, they will try and stonewall this as long as possible. And, of course, Congress has got its own investigation here. At best, this is a gray area. And at worst, there are court orders here that said that the White House should not have done this kind of thing. I think the White House is going to be dragged kicking and screaming into full disclosure.
Well, that brings us to tomorrow's federal court hearing. 16 terrorism suspects being held in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba claim the government may have used information from the videotaped interrogations, which their lawyers never saw because the tapes were destroyed. And it turns out months before the tapes were destroyed in 2005, the judge holding tomorrow's hearing ordered any evidence in the case of those terrorism suspects to be preserved.
Right. There is a gray area here, which is, was the order specifically about people who were interrogated at Guantanamo? It seems that this waterboarding episode did not take place at Guantanamo. So there may be some legal loophole that protects the administration here. In any case, it doesn't look good politically, and it may be illegal in terms of the law.
And you're saying the videos may not have been covered by that judge's order because the interrogated suspects were being held overseas at the time and then later transferred to Guantanamo Bay.
Precisely, precisely.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Leftist rebels in Colombia have issued a statement saying they will hand over three hostages. More than 750 people, including three Americans, are held by rebel groups in Colombia's jungles. A recently seized video shows former presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt sitting in the jungle looking thin. She was seized in 2002, and a letter she recently wrote to her mother has captivated human rights activists. In fact, the entire hostage situation has been playing out for the better part of a decade. But are Colombians even paying attention anymore? We spoke earlier with Adam Isaacson. He's head of the Colombia program at the Center for International Policy in Washington. We began by asking about Clara Rojas. Now, according to today's statement, she may be one of the hostages released. Over the summer, it was revealed that she'd had a child in captivity named Emmanuel, who's now three. The father is thought to be a rebel fighter. And we asked Adam what, if anything, has been heard about Clara or that boy recently.
Very little, only what was mentioned in Ingrid Betancourt's letter. The mother of the child is actually the woman who ran as Ingrid Betancourt's running mate on a presidential ticket in 2002 when both were kidnapped at the same time. And Ingrid basically says that as far as she knows, Emmanuel is well, but she has not seen Clara, her running mate, in many months. She had been separated from most of the other hostages. So we know that he is still alive, but yes, you have this horrible story about a baby born in captivity who has never left the jungle and is now 3 years old.
Right. Well, you mentioned Ingrid Betancourt's letter. This was, of course, just revealed recently. It was seized along with videotapes from some rebels. Give us some highlights of the letter.
It's clear that the guerrillas, probably at Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela's request, were bringing proofs of life of several of the hostages in order to sort of make a display of good faith. And we hadn't even seen an image of Ingrid Betancourt since 2003. The letter, she makes clear that she's being rushed into writing it as quickly as possible, but it goes on for about 6,000 words. And she talks about how depressed she is, how she's not eating, how her hair is just coming out in handfuls, how she misses her kids and how, you know, she has a silent birthday party for them on every one of their birthdays. And, you know, her guerrilla captors used to make cakes for her, but now she just pretends her rice and beans are a cake. She also just has some very beautiful but also very sharp words. She feels that the hostages have been forgotten. Yeah. And that they've been abandoned, and that, you know, they're just not a politically correct subject. And she's no kind words for the people, the politicians who would readily sacrifice them. Lots of kind words for the people who have actually tried unsuccessfully to get them free.
Well, her mother is one who's been fighting for her freedom, but is she right? Have they been forgotten?
They largely have. I mean, Colombia, I guess it happens here in the United States, too, where, you know, a missing child somewhere can make everybody forget the Iraq War for a few days. It's the same thing. The attention span is short. A scandal in Bogota can make people forget about the hostages for a long time. The problem is also the FARC have held them so incommunicado. The FARC is the guerrilla group that's holding them. They've held them so incommunicado that new news does not emerge very often.
Well, tell us more about the FARC. They began as a leftist movement. Many are now saying that drug trafficking has replaced their original ideological agenda and that they're just a criminal organization. Do you agree? I mean, what are they fighting for? Why are they holding hostages?
Yeah, I don't totally agree they're a criminal organization, and the main evidence of that is that we just haven't seen the money they make from the drug trade being used, you know, to buy villas or swimming pools or plowed into Swiss bank accounts. They seem to be buying it all for guns, and those guns are for something, to gain power in the country. They were founded in 1964, though, you're right, with a lot of influence from the international communist movement, but they were largely, and they remain, an organization of peasants, of people with very little education from rural Colombia. People have been brutalized their whole lives, and now that they're armed, are giving back as good as they ever got.
Well, why can't President Uribe's army just defeat them?
Well, there's about anywhere between 15 and 25,000 of them. They're scattered all over a country the size of Texas and California combined. a country with impenetrable jungles and no road network. It's very easy for guerrillas to hide. It's just an immense expanse of territory where you'll never really wipe them out.
Well, and President Uribe is considered a hardliner towards the rebels. His predecessor took a very different tack. Explain the difference.
Sure. Andres Pastrana was the president from 1998 through 2002. He did two things at the same time. The first was he tried to initiate a peace process with the guerrillas. He went so far as to pull the troops out of an area about the size of Switzerland and let the guerrillas have it, basically, so that talks could occur there. Those talks fell apart in 2002. At the same time, Pastrana oversaw the beginning of the biggest military buildup in Colombian history, and he oversaw the initiation of Plan Colombia, sort of the framework for what's been $5 billion in U.S. aid since 2000.
Well, let's take this one step at a time. You say that he, you know, tried to have these negotiations where he would give the rebels a zone in which there could be negotiations. Do we understand that during that time, in fact, what the rebels did was use that sort of ceasefire to build their own arms up?
Yeah, the what did give the guerrillas was a place where they had all the rest and relaxation that they wanted. They could train their troops. They even grew some coca there. They probably held hostages there. On the other hand, by 2000-2001, while they had that zone, they were starting to suffer some military defeats. They certainly did not come out of the peace process militarily stronger than they went into it.
So what's happened with President Uribe's plan to have this same, sort of peace zone?
The FARC want 800 square kilometers in southwestern Colombia with the military pulled out of them, the towns as well as the countryside. And Uribe absolutely will not do that. I mean, he ran for president in 2002 as the no demilitarized zone candidate, basically. They've been going back and forth on this precondition for talks, never even getting to talks. Then Uribe did make the announcement that he would be willing to demilitarize 150 square kilometers instead of the full 800 of area that was already rural, with international observers, and ideally without the FARC being armed. It's pretty plain that the FARC probably won't accept that proposal, but politically it's smart for Uribe to have, you know, made the show of flexibility and leaving the ball in the FARC's court. The FARC have not yet responded to that proposal.
What's the U.S. role in all of this? You mentioned U.S. aid. Figures being released this week on the 2008 foreign aid bill show Colombia slated to receive over $500 million. Colombia is the largest recipient of U.S. aid in this hemisphere under the Bush administration's Andean initiative that was meant to stem the flow of narcotics into the U.S. and to combat this insurgency in Latin America, the leftist insurgency. With all those strings attached to Colombia, why isn't the U.S. pushing more for there to be talks or the hostages to be released?
The United States has been sort of in a bind on this, too. President Álvaro Uribe of Colombia is one of the only real enthusiastic allies they have in Latin America right now. Colombia is bordered by Venezuela and Ecuador, two countries with presidents who routinely criticize the United States. And so there's a feeling that Uribe is sort of a bulwark, and they don't want to jeopardize that relationship by disagreeing with him on an issue like this. On the other hand, the United States doesn't have a real long record of wanting to negotiate with terrorists anyway. The only other option would be trying to attempt a military rescue. And right now what we've heard is that, you know, neither country has the intelligence or the ability to carry out a rescue when it's well known that the FARC, on the first signs of an attempted rescue, will kill their captives. So they're sort of stuck right now. When President Chavez was facilitating dialogues on this from August to November, the United States actually kept a pretty open mind about it. The Bush administration allowed mediators access to FARC prisoners in U.S. jails and did not say no to any possibility. They kept their options open, and they should be praised for that flexibility.
Columbia scholar Adam Isaacson. So when we come back, what's the end game? And later, Putin is Person of the Year. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with a conversation on Colombia. Adam Isaacson is with the Center for International Policy in Washington. He was just telling us that Venezuela's leader, Hugo Chavez, attempted to broker some sort of release of hostages, but Colombia's hardline leader, Uribe, broke off those talks. And we were also speaking of Colombia's longstanding role as a key partner in America's war on drugs. Adam telling us that the Bush administration considers the Colombian president, Uribe, its most important ally in the region. But I asked Adam if Uribe is the right man for the job. Rumors swirl that he has close ties to the late drug lord Pablo Escobar. Escobar operated the Medellin drug cartel, and President Uribe is from Medellin.
Well, yeah, there have been rumors swirling around Colombia and popping up once in a while in Colombia's press about President Uribe's past. he is a politician who cut his teeth in Medellin of the early to mid-1980s, when that city was completely dominated by Pablo Escobar. He was even briefly mayor of Medellin in 1983. He was head of Colombia's version of the FAA at a time when narco planes were leaving for Miami at a frightening pace. So, there's a lot of those kind of questions. There's questions about maybe his family members' ties with some of the narcos of the region at the time. And they've never been answered in any definitive way. Certainly, I think they bother U.S. officials, but there's no evidence of, you know, any recent, meaning last 15 years, recent dealings of Uribe with the narcos. And, in fact, he's been one of the most aggressive eradicators of coca, and he has certainly, with gusto, spent U.S. counter-narcotics money on things like interdiction. I mean, all those numbers are up. However, there's just as much coca and cocaine being produced in Colombia today as there ever was, despite all the money we've spent down there trying to eradicate it.
Meantime, we're hearing these stories. I mean, it was just stunning to see this female guerrilla, this was just a while back,
right,
who apparently had been in charge of a small child who was taken hostage. She was taken from a daycare center and held for ransom by the FARC. She was put in his care, and apparently her maternal instincts kicked in at some point.
Apparently, the FARC have kidnapped hundreds or even thousands of people. So has a smaller guerrilla group called the ELN for ransom. It's a main fundraising channel for them. It probably accounts for as much as a third of their income. And they have been really indiscriminate. They kidnap 90-year-olds. They kidnap 2-year-olds. As you know, children, parents will pay an extra premium for a small child, right? In this case, the baby's main guerrilla captor couldn't take it anymore, and she deserted the guerrillas in the northeastern jungles of the country and got a pilot to fly her to a place where she could turn in the baby. She, of course, has to worry about her security right now, and I'm sure she's under heavy protection.
But an incredible story of spending 24 hours getting out of the jungle with this child to return the child to the family. Prior to that, there were reports of a policeman who also spent days trying to, you know, get out, and he did also escape. And now we have pictures of this former presidential candidate, a video of her sitting there, you know, in chains. Where do you think this is going?
First of all, it has been a really eventful year about the hostages. I mean, with many years of hardly any news, in December of last year, we had one prisoner escape, and Uribe named him foreign minister within about 6 weeks. In May, we had another escapee, and then in June, we had the horrible news that 11 of the hostages were killed in what apparently may have been a bungled rescue attempt. And then, of course, the videos late in the year. That has created a huge momentum in Colombia. There has been more attention paid to the problem than ever. There's been a lot more international pressure with President Sarkozy of France getting involved in particular, and Hugo Chavez and others.
We should explain, because Ingrid Betancourt, the former presidential candidate, has dual citizenship.
She's
a French citizen. Yeah.
So there has been more attention this year, and that has meant more pressure on Uribe to at least show some flexibility, because the rest of the world is watching at least a bit more than they used to. You know, we're doing shows about this on the radio right now, which is great. The hostage relatives here in the United States are being more vocal and more active, which is great. And that does give us at least a glimmer of hope that this won't go on for, you know, another 5 or 8 years. But it is going to go on for a while longer. The FARC have shown an almost inhuman ability to just be patient and wait for their demands. They don't seem to be interested in haggling. Their demand is for those 800 square kilometers, and nobody has been able to get them down from that initial ask. It doesn't seem to be an initial ask. It seems to be their final offer.
And in exchange for FARC prisoners who are being held.
That's right, and they want 400 or 500 FARC prisoners in Colombian jails to be let out. And that's one of the things they'll have to talk about once they actually agree on the conditions where they're going to have these talks. Maybe you could get to some sort of haggling over those preconditions if you can have some face-to-face discussions between Colombian government or mediators and the FARC. But that's very hard to do right now, because the FARC are deep in the jungle, and now Venezuelan territory is not a possibility given the relations between Venezuela and Colombia at the moment. So, I mean, just even getting face-to-face to say, okay, what do you want? Can we talk you down a bit from those 800 square kilometers? What can we do? Even that is hard right now. But that's really where the hope lies right now, and with more international pressure, it's going to be easier to do.
We've been speculating as to whether or not the standoff with the hostages, you know, might come to an end, but do you ever think that the FARC members can be integrated into Colombia society? I mean, do you see a sort of an IRA ending to this?
Well, that's certainly the hope. You hope that there is some sort of peace process that maybe even includes some sort of political reforms. I mean, certainly one of the FARC's major demands is for land reform, and Colombia does have one of the worst systems of land holding in the world, so that would be a legitimate thing to negotiate. But as for the fighters themselves, people who, you know, probably joined the FARC when they were, you know, 13, 14, 15, people who have maybe a second or third grade education, if that, you're talking years of reintegration programs, years of psychological support, years of basic education until these people can even walk into a workplace and function like normal people. You know, people who have been raised in rural areas that are so remote, there's towns in Colombia where they don't even have currency. There's just no government presence. You're talking about moving people from the 15th to the 21st century in almost no time. And that will be a huge undertaking. They're already doing it with people who, there have been hundreds and even thousands of people who have deserted or who have, or paramilitaries who have demobilized. And it's proven to be really hard and really expensive. And also just fraught because you don't even know if these people have actually left the group they're in for good. So it's hard, but I mean, a lot of post-conflict situations have come up against these challenges, and Colombia will be no different. But that post-conflict period is still pretty far off, I'm afraid.
Adam Isaacson, he heads the Colombia program at the Foreign Policy Group, the Center for International Policy in Washington. Adam, thanks as always for speaking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, do you believe in God? We'll hear how some cultural icons answered that question. And Amahl and the Night Visitors. It was the first opera written just for TV. We'll hear some of that original recording. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Putin beats Gore for Person of the Year. That's after the news here and now. Nobel Prize winner Al Gore and Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling were in the running, but Russian President Vladimir Putin is Time Magazine's Person of the Year. The magazine says the Russian leader was chosen because of his extraordinary feat of leadership in taking a country that was in chaos and bringing it stability, because, as Time writes, if Russia fails, all bets are off for the 21st century. So Putin, according to Time, brought Russia back, but they add it's at a significant cost to the principles Free Nations prize. We're joined by Marshall Goldman, who's senior scholar in the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. His upcoming book is Petrol State, Putin, Power, and the New Russia. Welcome back, Marshall.
Thanks, Robin.
What do you think?
For me, it's a bit of a surprise, but the description you read from Time magazine seems to fit very appropriately.
Because?
Because when he became prime minister in 1999, a few months before he was made acting president, Russia was down. It had barely survived avoiding bankruptcy. There was talk of secession by various parts of the country. They had no money in the treasury. The economy was shrinking each year. Now, whether Putin had anything to do with it or not, the point is that today Russia is growing at 6 to 7% a year. It has money in the treasury. It's gotten itself out of, more or less out of Chechnya. At least it's not festering in the way that it was before. And so if you look at Russia, it's new, it's assertive, and you could really say Russia is back. And that is largely due to the fact that oil prices are up, but Putin at least didn't follow up the process.
Well, but is there a cost to Putin being in charge and Russia being back?
Sure, there is a cost, and it's unfortunate because I'd like to think that he could have done what he did at the same time without destroying freedom of the press or pretty strong pressure on the press, that he could have allowed more democratic spokesmen and parties to operate. But he felt threatened. He really felt that Russia was under pressure from inside the country and from outside the country. And in the process, he trampled on a lot of the things that we in the West hold very important.
Well, Time defends the choice. I mean, they remind us that there's precedent for this. You know, they picked Joseph Stalin twice. And they say the Person of the Year is not an honor or an endorsement. It's a recognition of the most powerful individual shaping the world. Is he, in your mind, one of those?
He is. This is reflected in a variety of ways. Just recently, a new man was appointed the head of the International Monetary Fund. The Europeans traditionally make that nomination without really the vote of others. And Putin said, "What is this? Why didn't you consult us? We are important. We have money in the treasury. We are a country that should be considered. We should not be taken for granted." And Putin went ahead and actually nominated another person who didn't get it, but at least as a defiant show of what Russia should be doing and should be taken into consideration.
Russia also just made its first shipment of nuclear fuel to Iran.
Yeah.
You know, what are your thoughts about Russia's role in Iran?
Well, it's been holding back a little bit until now. Iran is its neighbor, so if there's going to be trouble in Iran, Russia is going to feel it. But the Russians are, you know, they do have a way of making mischief, and they argue that Iran was going to buy this equipment. They wanted to sell it because they needed the jobs, they wanted the business. I'd like to think that they're going to be more cooperative with the West, but in this case, it's again, one of the signs that Russia can still make trouble.
And yet some would say it's the Bush administration that hasn't seen a way to communicate with Iran, just to at least, you know, keep your enemies close, your friends close, your enemies closer. Could some say Putin is making a wiser move and at least keeping his arm around President Ahmadinejad's shoulder?
There is some sign that Russia has been trying to temper Iran's behavior to restrain them. They could do more. I mean, for me, it would be wonderful if Putin not only was the man of the year, but also got a Nobel Prize for bringing disarmament and peace and holding back the nuclear rearming of Iran, and the same thing with North Korea. He could play a much more positive role. So far, he has not really exercised what I would like to think is responsible leadership in that way.
Well, and let's speak of leadership, because he apparently plans to stay in a leadership position for a long time. He sort of handpicked his successor.
Yes.
And, you know, what's your take on that? Is he really moving aside when a new president is soon elected?
It's going to be very interesting to see, because once you are the president of Russia, you have the most power. You have the right to dismiss the prime minister, which now the new man, Medvedev, can do to Putin. But Medvedev has been very loyal to Putin, been really his protege, and it will be interesting to see when push comes to shove, what happens. One way I think you can measure it, Putin has these very palatial presidential homes. I've been in the one in outside Moscow and the one in Sochi on the Black Sea. If Putin moves out of those, because those are the presidential places, lets the new man, Medvedev, take them over, that will be a sign that Putin really is taking a back seat. But if he holds on to them, that suggests that he's not prepared to give up all the perquisites of the office.
What about Putin's relationship with, in particular, George Bush and the U.S.? George Bush once said that he looked in Putin's eyes and saw his soul. Time magazine and others, you have said that you would look in those eyes and maybe not see the same thing, that he's cold and calculating.
Yeah.
And Putin tells Time magazine that America treats Russia like an uninvited guest at the party.
Yeah.
Is part of U.S.-Russian relations about Putin's feelings, you know, hurt feelings, or how he's treated?
Very much so. Very much so. And you can see that in not only what Putin has said, but what some of the other leaders have said. The governor of St. Petersburg, for example, said that we've been taken for granted, and she said now we are no longer going to be pushed around. And you know, it's clear that they've been suffering from an inferiority complex this way. And what Putin has done is standing up, and he said just recently in a speech in Munich that Russia is back. We've got to be treated with respect. The United States made promises to us. NATO made promises to it. You didn't hold to those promises. And then he says, but my personal relationship with Bush is very good. He's a man I can do business with. Well, if you have a long memory, you remember that's what Margaret Thatcher said about that yokel from Stavropol, Gorbachev. Well, what Putin just did is, well, I could do business with this yokel from Texas, Bush. And it's a much more assertive statement now. And that's why the Russians like Putin. He's really standing up for Russia.
Marshall Goldman, very briefly, Putin, his hero is Peter the Great. Do you think, as time asks, he will be seen more as Joseph Stalin or Peter the Great, an autocrat or a reformer?
Well, he's going to be a part of a reformer, and I hope he doesn't end up with the downside, because Peter the Great did great things, but also he sacrificed hundreds of thousands of lives to build St. Petersburg. I hope Putin doesn't have to do that.
Marshall Goldman, senior scholar in the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. His upcoming book, Petrol State, Putin, Power, and the New Russia. Marshall, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
And a quick look ahead at some of the stories we'll be covering in the coming days. We're going to take a look at the Ron Paul campaign. Supporters of Ron Paul have broken records raising money for this anti-government libertarian from Texas. How do they do that, and what does he stand for? We're also going to speak to the choir master, that's Sir David Wilcox. He's still conducting while approaching 88. That's our Christmas Day gift to you. Don't miss that story. You're listening to Here and Now. On a recent visit to the Haggerty School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Newbery Award-winning children's book author Susan Cooper dispensed advice and answered questions from a room full of kids.
Have you ever used an idea from when you were younger, like when you were a kid?
I think almost certainly I have used ideas that I had when I was a kid, but without knowing it. And also, I've been keeping notebooks ever since I was a kid. When you, just a notebook, everybody should do this if you have any thinking about being a writer.
The kids also recited a poem from Susan's best-known works, the five-book series known as The Dark is Rising.
When the dark comes rising, six shall turn it back. Three from the circle, three from the track. Wood, bronze, iron, water, fire, stone. Five shall return and one go alone.
The Dark is Rising is also the name of the second book in the series. It centers around Will Stanton, a young British boy who discovers on his 11th birthday, which happens to fall right before Christmas, that he can do magic. He's a member of the Light, a force for good, and during the Yuletide season, he battles agents of the dark who threaten to overtake the world. Sound a little like Harry Potter? Well, The Dark is Rising was written over 30 years ago, and though it was made into a less-than-successful movie earlier this year, the books still have many fans, including Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. She caught up with Susan Cooper and asked about her book's enduring nature.
It's interesting that they don't seem to date. The first book, in my view, the kids sound a little dated. The dialogue is full of things like gosh and golly. But the stories, the kids today seem to respond to them just as their parents did. I'm not sure, I don't think I've covered three generations yet, but certainly two generations. I think fantasy can do this. You know, it might be harder if they were very realistic and set in a particular period.
What drew you to fantasy?
I think fantasy takes hold of you rather than you taking hold of it. Every time I sit down to write a piece of fiction, it seems to turn into fantasy sooner or later. I think it's if you think in metaphor rather than directly. I started life as a newspaper reporter, so goodness knows I was writing about realistic things. Maybe my head thought that if it was going to do fiction, it should go all the way.
What amazes me when you talk about the struggle between the light and the dark about these books is that Will Stanton, who discovers that he's part of the light, the force for good, it's a force for good, but they're immortal, so they're not quite human, and it's sort of almost a cold goodness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think I show the dark and the light as extremes, and an extreme is dangerous. Basically, the books are about the good and the evil that is in each one of us. There are characters in the books who, being human, are victims both of the dark and the light. And the theme is how difficult it is, just in the process of human life, to balance our very precarious position between these two extremes.
The Dark is Rising, the second book in the series, was made into a film. And I think it was Ty Burr of the Boston Globe who said it. He knew devoted fans of the book, and he said that the people who made the film should go into a witness protection program from devoted fans of the book because it did take liberties.
Yeah, I wrote Ty Burr a fan letter after that review. The book is just different. I mean, the film is different from the book. I don't know whether the film sends people back to the book. If they do, they will be in a different place.
When you started writing this, you know, this was in the 70s, and we are now 30 years later, and as we heard, children are still quoting the poem from the books to you. What does that say to you, that over 30 years, people still have been reading these books?
Well, the world doesn't change very much. Human nature doesn't change very much. Our dilemma in the world doesn't change. I was a child in the Second World War. These kids are faced with the pictures coming out of Iraq. Wars still happen. people still do the same things. Children still learn have to learn the same, oh, not lessons. Children still have to learn how to cope with figuring everything out. And if the books helped a little bit 30 years ago, maybe they just go on helping. I hope.
Children's author Susan Cooper speaking with Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. Back in a minute with our jazz picks, Here and Now. And Here Now, our jazz aficionado James Isaacs dispensing with the small talk, because James just can't wait to share his picks for holiday gifts for jazz lovers, correct?
Yes, indeed, Robin. And let us start with this song. I take you back to 1958. The place is a concert hall in Sweden. Just sit back and enjoy.
I don't know why, but I'm feeling so sad. I long to try something I've never had no kissing. Ooh, what I've been missing. Love a man, oh, where can you be?
Please note that I'm standing with my hand over my heart in noting that this is Seraphon. Tell us about this song.
Well, it's Loverman, of course, and this is an enduring jazz ballad that Seraphon absolutely owns, along with Billie Holiday, I should add that. This concert recording is part of an 8-CD boxed set from the Naxos label. You can also purchase this Vaughn DVD individually, but I'm recommending it as part of this year's big-ticket holiday gift. Lists for about $120, but it's well worth the money.
Well, it seems incredible. Tell us more about this box set.
10 hours of music inside includes vintage live discs taken from European television programs. You've got John Coltrane in this box set, Duke Ellington, Charles Mingus, Dave Brubeck, Dexter Gordon, and more. Each DVD contains a well-illustrated booklet with informative notes. There's first-rate sound. The video transfers, black and white, are beautiful. And I know I'd be knocked out to receive the full collection as a gift this year or any year.
Okay, this sounds like just a terrific present for jazz fans, casual or devoted. So make a note of that. And by the way, we will. Everything will be on our website, here-now.org. Okay, James, next, the smaller gems. And the first one is from someone we don't usually think of as a jazz artist. It's Queen Latifah, the rapper and actress nominated for an Oscar for Chicago. But you are loving this CD. Tell us about it.
I am, Robin. It's the one called Travelin' Light on the Verve label. And it's one of the pleasant surprises of 2007. It's also nominated for a Grammy this year in the Best Traditional Pop category.
Yeah, but you're hearing the jazz in it, so what are you liking?
Even though this isn't her first stab at an album for people who fondly remember, well, let's say Dinah Washington and the aforementioned Billie Holiday, this one is for the most part highly focused and well thought out in its eclecticism. So you've got older standard tunes. You've got pop tunes that are more contemporary in nature. There are bossa novas. There are numbers with a bossa nova feel to them. Most important, Queen Latifah is an excellent voice. So let's listen to her version of the 1975 Phoebe Snow top 5 hit, Poetry Man.
When I am with you, I have a giggling teenage crush. Then I'm a sultry vamp, yeah. A sultry vamp. Whoa, talk to me some more. You don't have to go. You're the poetry man. You make things all right.
You know, I learned recently, Robin, that Poetry Man is a favorite song of Queen Latifah's mother. That's why she chose to do it on this album. She treats this piece with both delicacy and tensile strength. So I say, all hail Queen Latifah's vocal on this song. In fact, I should say vocals, because she was multi-tracked on the tune that we just heard.
That's Queen Latifah's new CD, Travelin' Light. Another one to note. Now, from a queen to a king, we hear a lot from this time of year. We're not talking Elvis, that's later. Who are we speaking of now?
The late Nat King Cole. His interpretation of the Christmas song, a.k.a. Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. At this point, it's more a part of Christmas than actual chestnuts roasting on any open fire. But I've not brought us anything Christmassy today from the singularly sublime singer and pianist, Nat Cole. The Collector's Choice label has undertaken a series of CDs. Each one combines two Nat Cole LPs originally made for Capitol Records. This one has the albums Welcome to the Club from 1959 and Tell Me All About Yourself, and that's from 1960.
And which are we going to hear?
It's the tune called Until the Real Thing Comes Along, and this is The Real Thing.
My heart is yours, what more can I say? I'd sigh for you, I'd cry for you. I'd tear the stars down from the sky for you. If that isn't love, it will have to do. Until the real thing comes along.
So as we listen, James, what is it about Nat Cole's version?
I mean, aside from that silky voice and that smooth delivery?
Yeah, other than that.
Okay. Well, I love the way the orchestra plays in double time while Nat's vocal is in half time. It's at once a nice bouncy effect that sets off the heartfelt vocal of Nat Cole.
Okay, well, listen for that. James, we are going to stay in the Cole family with your next choice, and for many people, this is going to be news.
Yes. Many people don't know that Nat Cole has a very musically talented younger brother named Freddie Cole, who's now not so young. If the truth be known, he's 76, I believe. Freddie Cole has a most alluring, smoky voice. His CD with the Bill Charlap Trio is called Music Maestro Please, and it's on the High Note label.
So compare and contrast, you know, his voice with his brother's.
Well, certainly there are similarities in their phrasing, but there's that huskiness in Freddie Cole's voice that I find so attractive, especially when he offers a ballad like this one. The tune is My Ideal, a song that's been recorded many times by numerous jazz musicians, but Freddie Cole makes it his own.
Will I ever find the girl in my mind, that one who is my ideal? Maybe she's a dream, and yet she might be just around the corner waiting for me. Will I recognize the light in her eyes that no other eyes reveal? Or will I pass her by and never even know that she is my ideal?
Boy, you know, what a family.
Yeah, Natalie Cole, yeah. We've been mentioning her. Of course, yeah. She's had tremendous success in the music business over the years. She's multi-Grammy artist, et cetera, et cetera.
And Uncle Freddie, as we hear. That's My Ideal. It's from the CD Music, Maestro Please, by Freddie Cole and the Bill Charlap Trio. So finally, James, would you take us home? And we understand it'll be on a very different note.
Indeed. I've got an old Yuletide favorite for you, Robin.
Yes, I often, when I'm caroling, try to work in a little
many
hound dog.
Many times I've done so in the past.
The old Christmas standby, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
No, Robin, you're not barking up the wrong tree. Not long ago, the Koch label dropped this audacious and effervescent CD by pianist Cyrus Chestnut. Cyrus plays Elvis. I say audacious because Elvis and jazz customarily don't go together, at least in most minds. But Cyrus Chestnut and his musicians make the project work out just fine. He's rearranged Elvis's stuff, but never to the point of unrecognizability. Also, Elvis loved gospel music, and Cyrus Chestnut's piano approach is steeped in gospel. So I urge listeners not to have suspicious minds.
I see.
When it comes to Cyrus Plays Elvis.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. Will have his list of holiday picks on our website, here-now.org. James, have a wonderful holiday season.
Robin, to you and all of our listeners, season's greetings, and now let's lift our glasses to a great 2008.